outside. How did that happen? They all fall silent for a moment.
Maybe she answered the door,
Matthew suggests, no doubt thinking of his own Dana, inexplicably found dead outside of her own room.
Possibly, David says, thinking aloud. But judging from the position of the body, she was standing at the desk with her back to the door when she was strangled. She either answered the door to someone she knows and trusts, or at least recognizes, one of us perhaps, and was comfortable enough to let them in and then turn her back on them, or someone unlocked the door without her being aware of it.
But that's not possible, James says. The keys are kept behind the reception desk.
Then he colors, as if realizing the inadequacy of his argument.
But there isn't always someone there,
David points out.
Not this weekend.
Henry says,
someone could have taken the key if there was no one in the lobby to see them.
But wouldn't she have heard the door open?
Ian asks. David raises a hand, calling for quiet. The sound of the wind howling violently outside answers Ian's question.
Jesus,
Lauren says, in deep dismay. Riley blurts out, with barely concealed hysteria.
You're suggesting that there's someone else in this hotel? A killer? Who can get into our rooms?
Her eyes are wild. Gwen looks anxiously at Riley and says quickly,
maybe the door was already open. Maybe she left it open. Maybe she just came up to get something.
Maybe,
David says. There's a long silence as everyone ponders the position they are all in. David says again,
I suggest we search the entire hotel, including our own rooms, unless there is anyone here who objects.
He surveys them all carefully. He wants to know if anyone has anything to hide. And he wants to find out if there is someone else here, someone they don't know about. The guests look at each other uneasily, but no one objects.
Shall we cover her?
Bradley asks, his voice uneven.
No, leave her as she is,
David says. He adds,
it would probably be better if only some of us search, and the rest of you go back downstairs and stay by the fire. I'll need James and Bradley with me.
I'll go back downstairs, Riley offers quickly.
I'll come with you, Lauren says. I don't want to go around this place in the dark.
I'm staying with you,
Ian says protectively.
I'm not letting you out of my sight.
Henry says,
I want to help search.
He turns to his wife and says,
why don't you go back downstairs and stay warm with the others?
No, I want to be with you, Beverly says, as if being with her husband is the only way she will feel safe.
Her husband is the only one she knows here. David turns to Matthew.
What about you?
I'll join the search party,
Matthew says decisively. David says to Gwen,
why don't you go with Riley and the rest of them?
He's worried about her. She looks so frightened and vulnerable. She nods and slips away from him. David watches Ian usher Lauren, Gwen, and Riley out the door on their way back to the lobby. Riley follows Ian, Lauren, and Gwen out of Candace's room. She sticks so close to Gwen that she almost steps on her heels. Out in the hall, the darkness seems absolute, even though there's a pinprick of light ahead from Ian's cell phone. But she is at the back of the little group. As they make their way silently down the stairs from the third floor, Riley tries to extinguish the image of Candace's lifeless body from her mind. But she can't discipline her thoughts. Her imagination takes control. She imagines what Candace's final moments must have been like. Someone came to find her in that cold, dark room and snuffed the life out of her. Riley imagines how it must have felt to have that scarf pulled so tightly around her neck that she couldn't breathe. She must have struggled. Riley can feel her own breath quicken and become shallower. She glances uneasily over her shoulder into the dark. The darkness is like a drape of rich black velvet. You can't see past it. She realizes she is falling behind.
her feet not as steady on the stairs as the others. She grips the banister tightly. She ran so quickly up these stairs just a short while ago. But now, since seeing Candace dead, she feels like she's walking through molasses, one slow, thick step after another. She's not herself. She tries to hurry, to catch up before the others make the turn on the landing and the small beam of light disappears. She can't shake the sense that there is someone else in the hotel, someone watching their every move. He must have been watching Candace, and now she's dead. Maybe he's watching Riley now. Maybe he's behind her on the stairs, waiting to pick her off, the straggler left behind. Suddenly, she can feel him watching, knows that he is behind her, behind that black curtain, a grim reaper reaching out for her. She senses movement above and behind her on the stairs, hears someone, something. Panicking, she rushes toward the others, stumbling, leaning heavily on the banister. "Wait!" she cries. She tumbles into Gwen in front of her. Gwen is not so far away after all. Gwen takes her in her arms. "I'm right here, Riley," she says. "I think there might be someone up there," Riley gasps. The light from the cell phone flashes in her face, almost blinding her, then moves off, playing against the stairs and walls behind her. They all look up. They can't see far.
"I don't think there's anyone there, Riley," Ian says firmly.
"Come on," Gwen says, taking her by the arm. "We're almost there." David turns to the others.
"Let's start with the empty rooms on this floor."
David notices that this time, Bradley seems more distraught than his father. He watches as James quietly takes the keys from Bradley, whose hands are visibly shaking, and sorts through them. They start with the room next to Candace's, which is across the hall from Lauren and Ian's. James inserts the key into the lock as David holds the oil lamp up so James can see what he's doing. David glances over his shoulder at the rest of them, hovering in the darkened corridor. The door swings open, and David enters the room first, carrying the lamp. The others follow, some with iPhones giving off beams of light. There's nothing there. The room is pristine, as if waiting for the next guest. They check the bathroom, the closets, look under the neatly made bed. There's nothing. They exit the room and move on to the next unoccupied room, the one next to Candace's on the other side. It's empty as well. It's when they move to the last unoccupied room on that side, across the hall from the room currently occupied by Gwen and Riley, that they find something disturbing. James inserts the key and opens the door, David beside him with the light. James's face registers surprise, and David turns his attention away from the owner to the room itself. The first thing he notices is that the bed has been slept in.
"Nobody move," David says tersely.
He stands still, listening keenly for any sound. His eyes fly to the bathroom door, which is open. Someone has been in this room. Maybe he's still here, in the bathroom. He feels a chill of fear, but something, perhaps his sense of hearing or smell, something running below his conscious radar, tells him that there is no one else here. He steps quickly to the bathroom and looks inside. It's empty.
"What's going on?" Beverly asks from the corridor, her voice shrill.
"Nothing. It's fine," David says.
The others spill into the empty hotel room, and David hears their gasps of dismay at the sight of the unmade bed.
"Christ,"
Henry says, his voice tense. David walks up more closely to the bed, its covers thrown back in disarray. The oil lamp casts a small pool of flickering light as he moves observantly about the dark room. There's no luggage, no clothing, no sign of anyone's effects. It's as if the person had checked out and the room had not been made up. But there is no customary tip for the housemaid lying on the pillow or resting on the desk or the bureau, as you would certainly expect. David opens the closet doors, but finds only empty hangers. He looks again into the bathroom, more closely this time. There is water splashed around the sink, a towel left on the counter, but no personal items. The others are milling around the room now, clearly distressed.
I don't understand this,
James says, visibly unnerved. David asks,
is it possible that housekeeping simply missed this room, that the previous guest checked out and the room was missed somehow and not made up again? That would never happen, James says emphatically. This is a small hotel. It's not hard to keep track of the rooms. Bradley?
I don't know, Bradley says, sounding shaken. I think it's very unlikely. It's never happened before.
Well, it's either that, or someone we don't know about has been using this room, and possibly moving about the hotel without us knowing,
David says. The room is directly across the hall from the room Gwen and Riley are staying in. He feels a sudden fear for Gwen clutching at his heart. He looks around at the others, huddled together, their faces drawn.
Let's move on, David says.
Chapter 19. Henry doesn't know which is worse, the possibility that one of the people in their little group might be a murderer, or the possibility that there is someone they're not aware of, moving about the hotel, who has already killed two people. As they search Gwen and Riley's room, Henry wonders what it is they're even looking for. He's not sure why David suggested they search the guests' rooms, too, not just the empty ones, or why they all agreed to it. He doesn't know what David expects to find. It feels like they're playing at something, some sort of parlor game or murder mystery evening, with the lights out. Only no one's having fun. Beverly finds some medication in Riley's bag and holds it up to the light.
What is it?
Henry asks, for all of them. David looks at it.
For anxiety, he says,
and Beverly puts it back in Riley's overnight bag. Continuing with the third floor, they search the sitting room by the stairs and then the housekeeping closet. In Lauren's room, they discover that she uses strong sleeping pills, Ambien, but they don't find anything else of interest. At last, they are finished with the third floor. They move down to the second floor, where the rest of the guests have their rooms. David's room is in the northwest corner, directly below Gwen and Riley's, next to the sitting room. Across the hall from the sitting room is Dana and Matthew's room, kitty corner from David's. Next to it, across from David's, is another unoccupied room. They start with the empty room across from David's. It looks the way a properly made-up hotel room should look. Next, David leads them to his own room, across the hall. Henry's certain they're not going to find anything there. They move about in the dark with their fading iPhones, pulling open the drawers of the bedside table, the dresser, the bathroom vanity. Matthew stirs the cold remains of the fire in the grate with a poker. The room, the entire hotel, is chilly, and Henry wishes he had a thicker sweater or his jacket. Henry looks under the bed. Beverly looks through David's luggage while David watches, picking through the contents of his overnight bag, boxer shorts and socks, clothes, books, and opening zippered pouches. Meanwhile, Henry lifts the mattress and looks beneath it. He remembers hiding porn mags under his mattress as a teenager. Finally, they are finished, and as they all leave the room, Henry casts an anxious look out the window. The sky is black outside. The wind howls around the hotel. He can hear the creaking of the ice-coated branches sawing in the wind outside the windows. He feels a sinking sensation in his core. More than that, it's a sensation of dread. They step out of the room, and David closes his door behind them. The others are already entering Matthew's room, where David leaves it to them to feel through luggage, open drawers, lift carpets, stir ashes. He watches Matthew's reaction as his and Dana's room and private belongings are searched. He is uncomfortable at having his things examined, but nothing more than that. David is startled When Henry finds a gun, it's in Matthew's luggage, properly locked and stowed, along with ammunition.
I have a permit, Matthew says a little defensively. I don't normally take it anywhere, he tells them. I keep it in my bedside table at home, in case of intruders, but I thought it might be handy if we did some skiing or hiking up here. There are bears. Better to be prepared.
He turns to James.
You can scare them off easily with the sound of a shot. Isn't that right?
James nods nervously.
Yes.
David nods, and Henry returns the gun carefully to the overnight bag and puts the bag back down on the floor. Matthew leans over and grabs the overnight bag and pulls it toward him and puts it on the bed. He takes the gun out of the bag and methodically loads it. David freezes. Everyone has stopped what they're doing to watch Matthew. He grabs extra ammunition and shoves it into his pockets. He's not looking at anyone. He holds the gun in his hand. David wonders if he should say something, do something. Time seems to stop. David's heart is racing. Everyone is transfixed by the sight of Matthew handling his gun, as if they are afraid that Matthew is the murderer and he is going to kill them all. But then Matthew looks up, and it's just Matthew.
We could use this for protection, he says, and the moment passes.
Henry and Beverly's room is beside Matthew's, across from the empty housekeeping closet. They find nothing there. Now even David doesn't know what they're looking for. He's starting to think he's on a fool's errand, searching the guests' rooms. The two rooms across from each other at the end of the hall, near the back staircase, are unoccupied and cleaned, prepared for the next guests. Saturday, 6:30 p.m.
We'd better search the rest of the hotel, James says, the entire first floor, and then the cellars.
James is very disturbed by the appearance of room 302. Nothing like this has ever happened before. He asks himself if it is possible that there is someone here that they're not aware of, some interloper. But he has no enemies, not that he can think of, no mad relatives hidden away, no disgruntled employees. He wishes now that he'd installed security cameras, but he hadn't wanted them in his quaint, old-fashioned hotel. He hadn't thought they would ever be necessary. But now, if only he'd had cameras installed in the corridors, they might have shown what happened to Dana, if it happened before the power went out. But then he realizes they wouldn't have been able to review the video anyway without electricity. James glances at Bradley. Bradley is standing in the hall with the rest of them, staring down at the floor, unaware that he's being observed. There's naked fear on his face, and something else that James can't quite read. It's a look he's seen before. James feels his stomach drop with a sickening lurch. He doesn't really know everything about his son. No parent does. Bradley has had some brushes with the law. James thought those days were behind them. Dear God, he hopes Bradley hasn't become involved with something bigger than he can handle. But then he assures himself that anything Bradley might be involved in couldn't have anything to do with this. Bradley is a good boy who once got involved with some bad people. But he'll talk to him when he gets a chance. He comes up beside his son and whispers,
Are you okay?
Bradley looks up at him, startled.
Yeah, I'm fine.
And that look on his face is gone, and he looks like he always does. And James tells himself he's worrying for nothing. This has nothing to do with Bradley. He's just frightened like everybody else.
Bradley,
James says,
you've got the lamp. Why don't you leave?
This time, they take the back staircase down to the first floor. It's the first time Beverly's seen it. It's narrow and uncarpeted. They go down single file, their steps echoing.
This was the servant's staircase,
Bradley says.
Is there an attic we should be checking out?
David asks.
No,
James says. They arrive at the bottom of the stairs, where a door opens onto a hall that runs along the back of the hotel. Immediately to the left is the kitchen.
Let's leave the kitchen and cellars for last, James says. Let's try the woodshed.
Down the hall from the kitchen is the door to the woodshed. They follow Bradley. Beverly hadn't really looked closely at the woodshed when she was here before, being in a hurry to follow the others to the ice house. But she looks at it now. It's really cold in here. The walls are simple barn board. It's not insulated. There's a large wooden stump with an axe plunged into it in the center of the earthen floor. Cords of wood are neatly stacked all around, kindling too. There are some gardening tools and a musty smell, but there is nowhere to hide in here. They move farther along the hall at the back of the hotel and turn left toward the lobby. On the right-hand side is the library. James opens the glass-paned door and they all follow him. There's nowhere to hide in here either. They move on next to the sitting room, but again, there's nothing to find. When they get back to the lobby, they turn down the corridor toward the bar. It yields nothing. Farther down the corridor is the door to James and Bradley's apartment. James unlocks the door and invites them in. The apartment is small but tidy and nicely appointed. There's no one there either. As they return to the lobby, Beverly is both relieved and disheartened. She doesn't know what they are going to do, how they will find the killer.
There's nothing left but the kitchen and the cellar, Bradley says.
Beverly feels uneasy at the thought of going down to the cellar, but she follows along as they go back to the kitchen.
Come in, Bradley says.
With Bradley holding the oil lamp aloft, they enter the enormous kitchen. It's half country kitchen, half industrial. Beverly notices the enormous refrigerator that must be 8 feet wide and which is now full of food that must be thawing and spoiling. There is an oversized island in the middle of the kitchen, obviously a busy workspace on most days. Cupboards line the walls, and there's a large double sink and an industrial dishwasher. Beverly watches James open the large refrigerator and look inside. Nothing. Then he opens the closet, and they all look inside with the aid of the sputtering oil lamp. It's empty, too. James turns to them and says,
"Only the cellar left."
He opens an old wooden door and automatically reaches for the light switch before remembering.
"Give me that," he says to Bradley and reaches for the lamp. "No, let me go first,"
Bradley insists and pushes past his father with the light. They creak down the rough wooden stairs. There are no backs on the stairs, and there's no handrail either. Beverly keeps her hand against the rough stone wall for balance. When she arrives at the bottom, it's like stepping into another century. Thick, heavy ceiling beams support the building overhead. The foundation walls are made of stone.
2 feet thick, Bradley says, pointing casually.
Beverly looks, impressed, at the whitewashed stone. The paint is flaking off.
Are there rats down here? She asks.
There are probably rats. Beverly is terrified of rats. This is the country, and the cellar is directly below the kitchen.
We take care of them, Bradley says. Don't worry.
How?
Henry asks.
Warfarin, James says curtly.
And Beverly's uneasiness increases. James seems uncomfortable about his guests seeing this rather primitive cellar, and possibly rats. It's nothing like the fancy hotel upstairs. He must feel like he's stripping down to his underwear in front of them, Beverly thinks. She sees a rude wooden shelf built into the stone wall that must be original to the building. It's empty. Bradley sees her looking at it.
We don't use the basement much, Bradley explains. We keep everything in the pantry upstairs.
Beverly gazes around the very large open space. The cement floor is uneven. There are some small windows set into the stone high up in the wall. A modern electrical panel stands out for being clean and new. The furnace is relatively new as well.
There's no one here, David says,
peering around behind the furnace.
We're not done yet, Bradley says.
He moves toward the back of the cellar and slips through another opening to the right.
The cisterns are in here,
he says, his voice sounding far away. Not wanting to be left behind, Beverly reluctantly follows the others and glances through the rough doorway. There are two large concrete square cisterns to the right.
Empty now, Bradley says.
Beverly shudders. She doesn't go inside the room with the cisterns. She stands at the opening, watching as Bradley looks down inside each one, holding the light aloft. David comes up beside him and looks down with him. Bradley shakes his head.
All clear,
he says.
Look, David says, his voice sharp.
Beverly follows where David is looking. There's a window on the far wall, near the ceiling.
Shit, says Bradley.
Beverly watches, tense, as Bradley approaches and examines the window. She can see that the glass is broken. There are fragments on the floor below.
The window is still latched,
David says, standing beside Bradley, studying the window.
So it might just be a broken window, Bradley says.
Or it could have been deliberately broken, unlatched from outside, and someone could have slipped in this way and latched the window again.
Beverly feels herself go a little faint. David says,
We'd better go outside and take a look around, see if there are any footprints. Bradley and I will go. Everybody doesn't have to come.
Matthew says,
I'll come.
Saturday, 7:10 p.m. Matthew pulls on his winter jacket and boots and follows David and Bradley outside onto the porch. The wind is a force to be reckoned with, angry and noisy. The trees seem to cower before it. They've checked all the first floor windows and doors from the inside, and they are all secure. There's just the one broken basement window they have to go look at now. Matthew wonders how they're going to make it around the east side of the hotel to check the window, given how slippery it looks out there. They've had to leave the oil lamp inside because no one wants to scramble over the ice holding an oil lamp. Instead, they've got Matthew's iPhone flashlight. David has hardly any charge left in his and wants to conserve it. But Matthew isn't going to lead the way. He's given his phone to Bradley.
Follow me,
Bradley says. They slide slowly across the front of the hotel and then round the corner and make their way along the side of the hotel, their hands against the wall for balance. As they near the basement window, they can see there is a broken branch lying in front of it, fallen from a nearby tree crippled by the storm. They bend down and peer at the window, Bradley shining the light. But they can't tell if the branch fell and broke the window, or someone used the branch to break the window. With the ice, they can't see any footprints.
What do you think?
Matthew asks, studying the window, the branches strewn about in front of it.
I don't know, David says, looking worried.
Chapter 20, Saturday, 7:30 p.m. David, Bradley, and Matthew return to the lobby, to the anxious faces of the others waiting inside. David sags into a chair by the fire and explains their findings to the others. He finishes wearily.
So, we have a room that looks like it's been used and a mysteriously broken window. Other than that, we haven't seen any sign of someone else in this hotel, or of anyone going in or out.
They all glance at one another in silence, as if they can't possibly make sense of this information. They're visibly on edge.
So, is there someone else here or not?
Riley asks, her voice strident.
I don't know, David says. Maybe, maybe not.
Ian says,
Are you really suggesting that it might be one of us that killed Dana and Candace?
Ian's voice rises with incredulity.
Why on earth would one of us kill either of them? We don't even know them.
We don't know that, We don't know that no one here knew Dana or Candace,
David says evenly.
I don't know anything about anyone here.
He looks around them as if daring someone to speak.
As far as I know, as far as we've led each other to believe, we're all strangers. But maybe that's not the case.
He looks around slowly at the assembled group.
In any event, when the police get here, there will be an investigation. They will look very carefully into Dana's background and Candace's background, and into all of us as well.
And he knows what that's going to be like. He watches the others as they look uneasily at each other.
Just for a moment, let's assume it is one of us. We need to know where everybody was this afternoon. Bradley saw Candace alive when he picked up her lunch tray from the library.
When was that, Bradley?
It was about 1:30, Bradley says.
David continues.
All of us were here in the lobby together, with the exception of James and Bradley until around 2, when Henry and I went to get wood and everyone seemed to go their own way. We all met down here for tea at 4 o'clock. All of us then went out to the ice house together and came back together, with the exception of James.
He pauses and adds,
Of course, Bradley, you came back in to look for her when the rest of us were in the ice house.
He gives everyone a frank glance.
But let's focus on where everyone was between about 2 o'clock and 4. I was in my room, alone.
Gwen says, Riley and I were in our room.
Lauren says, Ian and I were in our room, too.
Matthew says,
I was in my room. You told me to stay there. I only came out when I heard that scream when you found Candace dead.
Henry says,
I was down here, in the lobby. I fell asleep in my chair for a bit. Then I went upstairs to freshen up just before 4.
Beverly nods.
I was in our room. I came down briefly to chat with Henry in the lobby, but went back up to our room after. He came up just before 4.
James says,
I was in the kitchen, and Bradley was helping me.
David says wearily,
So, that doesn't help much, does it?
If you think it's one of us,
Henry says in the ensuing silence,
if I had to guess, my money would be on Matthew.
Matthew turns to him in shock. Henry's been thinking about this during the long, cold search of the hotel. If it's even possible that the murderer is one of them, maybe it's time to shake things up a bit. He's decided to play devil's advocate.
You're the most likely culprit,
he says mildly, turning on Matthew.
Maybe you killed Dana after your argument and Candace figured it out and you had to shut her up.
The others watch in alarm, but no one tries to defend Matthew. Lauren says,
How could she have figured it out?
I don't know. She seemed kind of snoopy to me. Or maybe.
He's thinking out loud here.
Maybe Candace was writing a book about Matthew, the famous wealthy businessman. Or about Dana, who was about to marry him. And Dana argued with her about it at the top of the stairs, and Candace pushed her down. And Matthew knew it must have been her that killed Dana, so he strangled her.
That sounds pretty far-fetched,
Ian says.
Murder is far-fetched,
Henry says.
We're not dealing with normal here. Somebody around here is a killer. Somebody had good enough reasons to kill Dana and Candace. I'm just trying to figure out what they are.
Lauren turns to Matthew and says haltingly, Candace was staring at you and Dana at dinner last night. Matthew looks back at her, frowning. He shifts uneasily in his seat.
Was she? I'm well known in the business world. Our engagement was announced in all the society pages. So, yes, it's possible she recognized me and knew who I was.
Lauren says, She knew who you were. She told us all at breakfast this morning.
But I didn't know her,
Matthew snaps,
and Dana didn't either. If she was writing a book about us, we didn't know about it, and neither of us have anything to hide, so we wouldn't give a shit.
Then Riley says, but maybe Dana did have something to hide, something you didn't know about. Maybe Candace knew about it and was writing about it, and she and Dana fought on the stairs, and Candace pushed her down. But if I didn't know about it, why would I conclude that Candace pushed her down the stairs and then kill Candace? Matthew says sarcastically.
Maybe you did know about it,
Henry says.
We only have your word for it.
Matthew leans forward and says, deliberately, I didn't kill anybody. Riley says, her voice intense, you brought a gun. Maybe you knew Candace was going to be here. Maybe you planned to kill her all along, but the thing with Dana happened first. I don't have to listen to this, Matthew says. Beverly breaks in, hold on. Maybe the fact that Candace is dead too means that Matthew didn't kill Dana and that he has nothing to do with this. Did you ever think of that? She turns to Henry and says, doesn't it make him less likely to be guilty?
Possibly,
Henry says. That's kind of what I was thinking, Gwen admits. If it was just Dana, then yes, I'm sorry, Matthew, but you would seem like the obvious suspect, especially since Beverly heard you arguing late last night. She turns to the others. But once there's another death, doesn't that make it seem less likely that Matthew did it?
She kind of has a point, Ian says.
Henry watches everyone carefully. He doesn't know anything for certain, but he's going to keep his eyes open.
If we could all just stop pointing the finger at me for a minute, there's something I'd like to bring up, Matthew says. He knows he sounds a bit aggressive. He doesn't care. They've practically accused him of murder, for God's sake.
What's that?
David says. I think James and Bradley are hiding something. James looks completely taken aback. Bradley flushes to the roots of his hair.
What do you mean?
James stammers. Matthew leans toward James and Bradley, who are seated together.
This is your hotel. Maybe you know something the rest of us don't.
Like what?
James says, on the defensive.
I don't know, but I've seen you two whispering together. What have you been whispering about?
We haven't been whispering,
James says, coloring.
Yes, you have. I've seen you.
Oh, for Christ's sake,
Ian interjects. They've got a hotel to run.
David turns to James, his face serious.
Is it at all possible that there is someone who might wish you or your hotel harm?
Matthew watches James closely. Out of the corner of his eye, he sees Bradley shaking his head. James shakes his head stiffly.
No, if I thought that was possible, I would have said so.
Matthew sinks back in his chair, dissatisfied, unconvinced.
I don't believe you.
He looks from James to Bradley and back again.
I still think there's something you're not telling us.
David watches as Gwen rises restlessly from her chair and wanders over to the windows. It's darker by the windows, but he can see her in the gloom. She looks out, pointlessly. No one is coming. David leaves his seat and goes to her. He can feel the others watching, but he doesn't care. She turns toward him as he approaches. Her eyes are troubled. There's something I have to ask you, she says without preamble, her voice a whisper.
Here it comes, David thinks. She's going to ask him about his wife. She's been listening to Riley. He's sure of it. He should have told Gwen about his past first. He should have told her last night. But it wasn't the right time.
You don't tell a woman you're terribly attracted to that you were once arrested for murder.
Anything, he says, his voice low, his expression open.
He will tell her the truth. It's up to her whether to believe him or not. He can't hide it. It's all over the internet. Gwen glances back at the others around the fire.
Not now, she whispers, but we need to talk, privately, at some point.
He nods. It will give him time to prepare what he's going to say to her, how to put it. He doesn't want to frighten her away. All Beverly wants is to go home. She wants to see her children. This hotel no longer seems lovely and luxurious to her. It's dark and cold and awful. She shudders when she remembers the cellar. It looked like it could be the setting for some horror film. She feels like she's living in a horror film. This can't really be happening, not to her. She's a very normal woman, with a very normal, even dull, life. Nothing exceptional ever happens to her. And deep down, she likes it that way. It's horrible to have Dana's body still lying at the foot of the stairs. Really, it's too much. She feels a bout of tears coming on and forces them back. She wants that body moved. She thinks it's beginning to smell. It has been lying there since sometime last night. It must be decomposing by now. That must be what that smell is. Can't anyone else smell it? She's always had a very acute sense of smell. She's sensitive. She's always been sensitive. Teddy's like that, too. Doesn't like tags in his clothes. Very fussy about his socks. She lifts her wrist to her nose and tries to breathe in her own fading perfume. As the time ticks by, she finds herself staring at Dana's body, draped in the ghostly sheet. She couldn't even look at it before, but she's glowering at it now, because she's afraid of it. She doesn't want to turn her back on it. It's irrational, but that's how she feels. She's unraveling. She thinks she sees something moving in the dark, over by the body, a dark shape, a rustling. And now it looks as if Dana is moving slightly under the sheet. She's heard about that, about bodies moving after death, shifting, because they're full of gas. She stares more intently. What is that? Is that a rat? She screams. Henry bolts out of his chair. There's a rat! Over there! By the body! Beverly cries, getting up and pointing. Everyone turns to squint into the dark where she's pointing. That's impossible, James says defensively, jumping out of his chair. You already admitted you have rats, Lauren points out uneasily, tucking her feet up underneath her on the sofa. Not up here, James says. But there's a dead body up here, Lauren says, and maybe it's attracting them. She shudders visibly. Oh, God! I can't stand this! Beverly agrees with Lauren. She can't stand it either. She starts to sob and shake. Out of years of habit, she turns and buries her face in Henry's chest. He puts his arms around her, and even though she's still furious at him, it's comforting.
We need to get that body out of here,
Henry says crossly.
We really shouldn't move it, David begins. To hell with what we should and shouldn't do, Henry cries. There's a dead body there. It's festering and attracting rats, and it's frightening my wife.
Beverly lifts her head from Henry's chest and looks at Matthew. He's gone white. She's suddenly sorry for her outburst. I'm sorry. But Matthew ignores her and picks the oil lamp up from the coffee table and goes over to Dana's body. He holds the light over her, looking down, looking for a rat. It's a macabre sight, but Beverly finds she cannot look away. I don't see any rats, Matthew says sullenly. There aren't any. You must have imagined it. Ian gets up and stands beside him.
Still, maybe we should move her, he says gently.
He turns and looks back at David. David looks around the room, as if gauging the mood. Finally, he nods, as if he knows he's outnumbered. He takes his cell phone out of his pocket, pulls back the sheet, and snaps some pictures. Then he makes a sound of frustration and says,
Now my phone's completely dead.
He looks up at the others.
Okay, where can we put her?
The woodshed?
Bradley suggests tentatively.
No,
Matthew says.
There may be. Rats might get her there.
It makes Beverly feel sick, the thought of rats gnawing on Dana.
How about the ice house?
James suggests.
It's cold. It's completely sealed. Nothing can disturb her there.
Finally, Matthew swallows and nods. Beverly feels the most awful pity for him. She watches as David lays the sheet down on the floor beside the body. Then he takes Dana's feet, and Matthew takes her shoulders, and they clumsily lift her onto the sheet. Her head falls suddenly to the side. They wrap her up tightly in the sheet to make it easier to carry her. Bradley, Matthew, and David put on their coats and boots and begin the sad, awkward journey with the body out to the ice house. Once they're out of sight, Beverly bursts into tears. Chapter 21. Saturday, 8:30 p.m. On their return from the ice house, David puts two more logs on the fire and gets a good flame going. Then he turns reluctantly to the others, seated around the fire, their faces glowing in the firelight. Matthew sits apart, alienated from the others by his grief and by the suspicion that has been cast on him. The room is quite dark, with just the light thrown by the fire and the single, sputtering oil lamp. The other has run out of oil, and Bradley has explained, embarrassed, that there is no more. No one was expecting to have to use oil lamps. Riley fidgets nervously with the ring on her index finger, her version of wringing her hands, David thinks. She says, "What are we going to do?" David thinks that someone should give Riley another drink, or one of those pills of hers they found upstairs. He says, "We're going to stick together. We're going to make it through the night." The storm shrieks around them, slamming against the windows as if mocking him. "And in the morning, when it's light, I think we should try to make it out to the main road." He detects some nods in the shadows. "We'll stay here, in the lobby. If anybody has to go to the bathroom, we'll go together, in groups," David instructs. "And then, at daybreak, we'll go. Maybe the road crews will be out by then. We'll get help. But we have to stick together. Nothing can happen to anyone if we all stick together. Understand?" Everyone stares back at him. Now, one by one, they nod. Even Riley, who licks her lips nervously.
"It's still cold in here," David continues. "We need to stay warm. We have to keep the fire going."
He stops to think for a minute.
"We should get some more blankets from the rooms."
"I'm not going back upstairs," Gwen says with feeling. David is distracted for a moment by how anxious she looks. But they're all frightened. Other than keeping them warm and fed and all together in one place, he has no idea how to keep them alive.
"Our phones must be very low on battery. Mine's out," David says.
There are nods all around.
"Mine's still working, for now," Matthew says, "but it won't last much longer."
David turns to Ian and Bradley.
"Why don't we go upstairs now and grab some blankets?"
Bradley and Ian nod, and the three of them head for the central staircase, into the dark, Bradley holding up the oil lamp to light their way, leaving the others by the light of the fire. Gwen stares into the dark after them. She's reminded somehow of the story of Hansel and Gretel, lost in the dark forest, trying to make their way home, where they aren't even wanted. The fairy tale had terrified her as a child, and now she feels as if she's inside the story, in the dark forest, abandoned by those who love her. She shivers. She's letting her imagination run away with her. Riley watches and waits, her heart beating fast, like an over-revved engine that might burn itself out. She listens to every little sound, the wind against the windows, the crackling of the fire, the startling sound of the logs shifting suddenly in the fireplace. But she's listening for something else, something unexpected. She's listening for something that shouldn't be there. She pulls the blanket more tightly around her body,
She tells herself that they have to make it to the morning. Then they can try to get the hell out of here. She tries to think. Maybe there is a connection here that they don't know about, as David suggested. If anyone here knew Dana or Candace previously, they aren't admitting it. It's possible that Matthew's right, and James and Bradley are hiding something. She had seen James and Bradley whispering, too. Or Matthew might simply be trying to shift attention away from himself. She knows she's become a little fixated on David Paley, yet as much as she thinks he might have murdered his own wife, she's not particularly afraid of him now. But she wishes Gwen would stay the hell away from him. Saturday, 9:05 p.m. They settle into their sofas and chairs around the fireplace. They've eaten a meal, hastily thrown together by James and Bradley, with David keeping them company in the kitchen. James has brewed another big pot of coffee. No one wants to sleep tonight. No one wants to even close their eyes. They sit together in a charged silence. No one is talking about the elephant in the room. Gwen squirms in an attempt to find a more comfortable position on the sofa. She doesn't know who or where the killer is. She can't bear to think about it anymore. Her neck is stiff with tension. She just wants to survive. They will try to make their way out of here first thing in the morning. She's holding on to that. They sit wrapped in blankets with their fingers around their mugs of coffee for warmth. There's a bottle of Kahlua taken from the bar cart sitting on the coffee table. They take turns topping up their coffees with it. Maybe it's not such a good idea to get drunk, Gwen thinks, but the Kahlua tastes good and it's soothing. She notices gratefully that David isn't putting anything in his coffee. He's going to keep his wits about him, their protector. She has more faith in him than in Matthew, with his gun, which seldom leaves his hand. He plays with it restlessly. She wishes he would put it down. She wishes David would tell him to put it down, or take it away from him. It's making her nervous. The rest of them are now trying to talk about other things, other hotels they've stayed at, in other countries, anything to keep their minds off the long, dark nights stretching out in front of them. She finds her eyes drifting more and more to David as the night wears on. She keeps thinking about the two of them together the night before. Occasionally, in fact more and more frequently, he glances her way. He looks dark and solid by the meager light of the fire and the oil lamp. He's unshaven, but he wears it well, and a lock of his hair falls forward over his forehead in a way that she finds appealing. She wants to brush it back. She wishes that the two of them were sitting close together, sharing a sofa. But she's sharing a sofa with Riley. She wonders what David would think of her if he knew the truth about her. She's not going to tell him. Not yet. There's only one person who knows the truth about her, about what she did. And she's sitting right beside her. But Riley isn't going to say anything. Chapter 22. Riley's been slipping Kahlua into her coffee at a faster rate than the rest of them. They already think she's got a problem with alcohol. Maybe she does. But that pales in comparison to the problems they've all got tonight. She just wants to take the edge off. She notices the way Gwen and David are looking at each other and decides she's not having it. She can be a bit mean when she's had a couple of drinks. So, she says, venturing into a conversational lull, maybe we should get to know each other a little better. She's looking right at David. She's pretty sure, from the way he was last night at the dinner table, that he knows she's on to him. She knows who he is. She can feel Gwen tightening up beside her, bristling. But then Lauren says, sure, why not? She stares at Riley across the coffee table, challenge in her eyes. Why don't you tell us a bit about yourself, Riley? Like,
What exactly is bothering you so much?
Riley looks back at her, surprised and thrown off course. She doesn't like Lauren. She's seen her rolling her eyes, and now she's giving her a hard time. How dare she? Riley hesitates, angry at Lauren. Then she says, "You don't want to know." There's a warning in her voice. "Sure I do," Lauren says.
"Pushy bitch,"
Riley thinks. She pauses and then says, her voice icy, "I've seen things that would make your guts turn inside out. So, don't you dare judge me."
"I'm not judging you," Lauren says. "I just want to understand you. I remember when we first got here thinking that maybe you were disturbed in some way, because you seemed freaked out before any of this started happening."
Lauren leans forward in the dark. "So, do you know something about what's going on? Because I don't trust you." Riley freezes in her seat, speechless. She can't believe what she's being accused of.
"What are you saying?" Gwen protests from beside her, clearly indignant. "She doesn't have anything to do with this."
"Really? She may not be the one killing people, but I wouldn't be surprised if she knows something. Look at her."
Now everyone is staring at Riley. She can feel herself becoming agitated. She tries to stay in control.
"She has a point," Matthew says, glaring at her. "You've been really nervous since we all got here. Everybody can see it. I thought there was something wrong with you. So did Dana."
"Maybe we should all take a step back," Ian says calmly.
"I don't know anything about what's happening here," Riley protests.
"Tell them," Gwen says beside her, her voice bold and furious. "Tell them what you've been through. Tell them, or I will."
Riley flashes Gwen a grateful look. She sighs heavily and says, enunciating carefully, "I'm a journalist." She hesitates a bit too long, takes another gulp of her drink, more straight Kahlua than coffee by this point.
"Yeah? So what?" Henry says provocatively.
Riley, feeling cornered, turns her eyes on him. She hasn't really given Henry any thought, but suddenly she despises him. She looks around the room. She despises all of them, except for Gwen. Gwen is the only friend she has here.
"I was stationed in Afghanistan, mostly in Kabul. I spent almost 3 years there. I saw terrible things."
Her voice begins to shake.
"I saw so many civilians killed, children, babies, limbs torn off by bombs, just lying in the street. So much brutality."
She stops. She can't say any more. Her voice has fallen to a whisper now, and she feels Gwen put her arm around her shoulder. She focuses on the pressure of Gwen's arm around her, grounding her.
"Then I was taken hostage."
"What?" Gwen says beside her, obviously shocked. "You never told me that."
Riley stares down into her lap.
"It was kept quiet. I was held prisoner for 6 days, until they negotiated my release. Every day, they would hold a gun to my head and pretend they were going to fire. They would pick someone at random and shoot them on the spot."
Her entire body is shaking now, and it makes her feel ashamed, even though she knows she shouldn't be ashamed.
"I thought I could do it. These were important stories. They had to be told. So I stuck with it for as long as I could. You try to cope until you crack."
She waits a beat. "But after that?" She falters, her voice a whisper. "I couldn't do it anymore."
Gwen is rubbing her back now, in large, slow circles, comforting her. The others are deadly quiet. Riley focuses on the feeling of Gwen rubbing her back in firm circles. It feels good, actually, to get this out. She's tired of pretending she's fine when everybody's looking at her like they obviously think she's got a screw loose. At least now they'll know why. She reminds herself it's nothing to be ashamed of. Her illness is a sign of her humanity.